You're listening to the Archaeology Podcast Network.
Hello everyone and welcome to ADHD BCE. This is episode 5 of season 2, and in this episode we're going to be talking about something very close to my heart, and it's one of the biggest turning points in the entire human story, and that's farming. And we're not going to just be talking about where it began or how it spread, but what it did to us. Yeah, because if this episode is about understanding neurodiversity through archaeology, or even interpreting archaeology through a neurodiverse lens, then farming is probably the most important moment we can look at. And that's because for around 300,000 years, Homo sapiens lived as hunter-gatherers, and that's off the back of millions of years of similar subsistence strategies, hunting, gathering, and whatnot. And at this point in our story, we're always talking about small populations moving through landscapes and constantly adapting. And I think, yeah, so before farming began about sort of 12,000 years ago, the global population is estimated to be around 4 to 6 million people. By the time we reach the early centuries AD, that number has grown to somewhere between 170 and 300 million people. And of course, today we're up over 8 billion people. So let that sink in as a form of significance, because almost all this population growth happens after farming begins. And this is where it becomes relevant to this podcast, because there's an idea that a lot of you may have heard of in the neurodiverse world, which is called the hunter-farmer theory, or the hunter versus farmer hypothesis, however you want to term it. And we're talking there about sort of traits that we now associate with ADHD that may have been advantageous in hunter-gatherer environments. And then we're talking about sort of the high awareness, quick reactions, sensitivity to change, energy bursts, that sort of thing. And then farming, which is totally different way of living, which is it's all about repetition and structure, delayed rewards and sedentary life. This may have created a world that suits some minds, especially neurotypical minds, we might argue, and of course it adds challenges to others. And I'm not presenting that argument or theory as a fact, but just as a lens, because it's powerful. Because, you know, a late diagnosed neurodivergent, I have an experience of going through school system and trying to figure out how to be an adult, and then really struggling with life. And I think the one thing I love to look at, I've always felt this way when I first started learning about the origins of agriculture. I always had this thing that when we penned in the animals, we also penned in ourselves. And here's the deeper layer, because the human nervous system didn't evolve 12,000 years ago. I've mentioned it in the beginning of this season. It didn't even evolve 300,000 years ago. It was old by then. It's built on foundations hundreds of millions of years deeper than that. And these systems were designed for movement and unpredictability, scanning for threats and reacting. And within a few thousand years, we move from savannas to settlements, from, you know, and into cities and into classrooms. And that's not evolution catching up. That's behavior outrunning biology. And I think the best way to go with this episode is now to look at where farming begins. And in archaeology, we talk about the Fertile Crescent, and this is where we think it all started, and that they have the earliest well-understood evidence comes from the Fertile Crescent, which is sort of a curved region that stretches from eastern Mediterranean coast up through southern Turkey and down into Iraq. And it's back then, 12,000 years ago, it was a landscape that was rich in wild grasses, especially early forms of wheat and barley. And that's where domestication begins. And what does domestication mean? Let's slow that down for a moment, because when we say farming begins, what does that actually mean? It doesn't mean somebody suddenly invents agriculture. It began with gathering. And I mean, imagine harvesting wild wheat in the wild. When the wheat ripens, the seed naturally falls onto the ground. But if you're cutting it with a stone blade, the easiest plants well, you select the easiest plants to collect naturally, and normally the plants that don't fall apart as well. So without realizing it, you start selecting plants that hold on to their seeds. And over generations, those plants change. They become dependent on humans, like a form of pollination, I suppose. And that's domestication. And in the earliest domesticated plants, they would have been just einkorn wheat and emmer wheat and barley, lentils, peas, chickpeas, flax, that sort of thing. And we know this through archaeology, and we've discovered this at many sites through charred seeds and through changes in the plant structure, through microscopic wear on the tools as well, and now through genetics as well. And we know that it's not just a single invention, it's sort of a relationship. And the same thing with animal, because the earliest domesticated species to be domesticated was, I think, goats and sheep, then cattle and pigs. And it was all around 10,000 years ago and shortly after. And it begins with proximity. You know, it's an adaptation, isn't it? So our ancestors at this point were following the herds around, consciously or unconsciously started managing movement and protecting certain animals until eventually they changed too. And naturally, these early farmers, if you want to call them that, they would have selected the less aggressive animals, the smaller ones and the more predictable ones. And they eventually became part of everyday life. And I think that's a good point, because we're starting with the origins of agriculture. We probably need to go back a little bit before, and then we step into a wonderful culture called the Natufian culture, which these guys existed before full farming. And I think they're around 13,000 to 9,500 BCE, again in the Levant. But these guys were still hunter-gatherers. But something changes there, and people begin to stay in one place for longer than is usual for hunter-gatherer cultures, and they build more permanent structures, they gather wild cereals intensively, and they store food as well. And they start to bury their dead in the same places that they live in, and place or proximity, that the area begins to matter in a different way. And then something else happens here, and it's easy to throw in climate change as a catalyst for change. But we do have a mini ice age at this point called the Younger Dryas period, which is born on a much cooler, drier, and less predictable environment. And we think under that pressure, people potentially began to rely more heavily on controlled food sources. And they didn't just, it's not just because they didn't just choose to invent farming. It's likely that it is because conditions push them to it. So, if you think on the ground in reality, if your environment shifts and you're heavily invested, and maybe there's a bit of a population increase in that area, maybe there's other factors that mean that you're going to hang around in the same place, you're going to need to try and do something. So it's a reaction, isn't it? It's one of the likely causes or catalysts for the invention of farming. And especially you could look at it at this point as being on the threshold of farming, because people are no longer fully mobile, but they're not farmers yet either. And that kind of brings me into where I'd love to talk about, because I was very lucky that I got to excavate in Turkey for a few years, a few summers, a few excavations. And so let's move into Anatolia for a little while, which is part of the Fertile Crescent and where some early domestication was definitely going on. And I'll just mention a couple of sites that I was lucky enough to excavate. I only spent one season at Penobscot, and then I was lucky to spend a few seasons at a site called Bonjupluhuyuk, which was just a few miles down the road from the archaeologically infamous, legendary Çatalhöyük. So let's go there for a little while, because I have spent some time excavating in this landscape. So Penobscot and Bonjupluhuyuk, wow. What you see there is not a clean break into farming again. I mean, Penobscot was a multi-period site. I was lucky enough to excavate there. I excavated a Byzantine burial there. It was a Bronze Age burial, and we also found a much older burial right at the end, which was, forgive me, I can't remember now, it was a long time ago, but I'm pretty sure that was likely to be a Natufian Age burial. But so Penobscot was multi-period, but there's a crossover from that sort of Natufian culture into the early farmers, and I think we're talking about sort of 9,000 to 7,800 BCE, and these guys were still heavily reliant on wild resources there. Whereas, I can't remember how many miles it was. It's probably an hour or two's drive. I'm not sure. It's a huge place to keep it. Down the road, it's Bonjuklahui. We're talking more like 8,300 to 7,800 BCE. And that's what we see early sedentism, but not quite what you'd call farming, actually. Maybe small scale farming, but there was definitely a lot of usual sort of foraging going on as well. And now, of course, this was just before, about 1,000 years before Çatalhöyük was established. And I remember it sort of blew my little brain that just down the road, 1,000 years before, we get this sort of shift at Bonjuklu, because prior to that, obviously pre-farming, most houses were temporary and fully circular. Hunter-gatherer buildings and shelters tend to be circular just for the ease of setup. That's just how those guys did it. Whereas down at Bonjuklahöyük, which is an early agricultural settlement, they had fully square buildings. And then sort of in between that at Bond, you get this sort of curvilinear structure, like ovaloid structure, which I wrote my dissertation on the use of space and population density. And Bonjuklahöyük, I love it. What I want to do is sort of step into, if I can, sort of a lived experience. And it's going to be a little bit easier at Çatalhöyük there, because Çatalhöyük was, I think, in terms of a lived experience, was super intensive. So let's step into there, because the mind-blowing thing about Çatal is that there were no streets. Okay, so you moved around at Çatalhöyük over the roofs, and you walked across the rooftops, and to get into your house, you climbed down into the houses through the ceiling. Okay, so yeah, I mean, inside there would have been warm, it would have been obviously darker than out there. There would have been a hearth, and then there were these sort of raised plaster platforms for sitting and sleeping. And believe it or not, beneath those platforms were burials. So their ancestors were buried within the house, underneath the house, in the foundations of the house. So you could sort of get that shift from back in the hunter-gatherer days. Obviously, you'd be moving around the landscapes, whereas in farming, you're staying with your ancestors. And so that relationship between the landscape and becoming land that is owned is a huge shift. Because, you know, you're not just living on a farm or in a city or in a building, you're living in a memory, I suppose. And if we imagine daily life at Çatal, you know, that includes a lot of grinding grain, obviously, and that same repetitive motion again and again. And you'd have been living in these houses that have been smoke from the fires, the smell of animals and voices all around you. You were never alone. And from a neurodivergent experience, for some, I guess it could be stability, but for others, you know, that sort of predictable, structured grounding. And whereas, you know, for the neurodivergent, maybe that was a little overwhelming. It was too much proximity, too much repetition, not enough escape. And this is where environment starts to shape experience differently, depending on the mind living within it. And so, yeah, I mean, I think, so the point I'm sort of trying to get to is that, you know, for our nervous system's millions of years in the making, and then all of a sudden, a few generations, the subsistence strategy turns from hunting and gathering and moving through the landscape to staying in the same place and doing the same things. I mean, that alone, in such a short term time, I mean, even our nervous systems today are really struggling with that. You know, we can't wait to get out in nature or go and do something novel, find something different to do and express ourselves. Whereas, you know, the hunter-gatherer body moving through, we evolved for that. So we've created a life outside of our natural environment, of what humans evolved to be. So that's the sort of the shift in lifestyle that I think is the most significant change that humanity's ever experienced. So let's look now at what happened in very general terms, because we've only got so much time, about how farming spread. And I'm going to reference a culture a little later down the line, because obviously farming spread as an idea and something as movement. So maybe, you know, in a similar way that we talked with Andy, was it that episode about migration, about how we move through the landscape? Well, farming spreads as an idea, whether it's a general subsistence strategy that has more benefits or whether it was just an ideology, whatever it was. We see it move from Levant and Turkey out and up into Europe. And there's a wonderful period there around, in Europe, around 6,500 BCE. And this culture is called the Linaban Ceramic, or the LBK to abbreviate. And yeah, this is where farming spreads across Europe. And again, it's not just one clean wave. Sometimes it's people moving, sometimes it's ideas, both. But by about 5,500, we see the linear band ceramic culture spreading across Europe. And these guys have the long houses and they have proper fields and livestock and they clear the landscape. And it happens really quickly how they, you know, in terms, because there was obviously a pre-existing set of cultures there. We generalize them as the Mesolithic hunter-gatherers. Well, I mean, I remember writing an essay on this back at uni, and I can't remember the paper. It was something along the lines of warfare, violence, and slavery in prehistory or something. There was a joint paper on that, and there was an article in that, and it was and it sort of detailed, especially in Germany, and it's around the lowest soils, the rich, fertile soils across Europe, where you get the first farmers. And this is evidence of serious tension and violence between the new farming cultures and the pre-existing Mesolithic cultures. You get Mesolithic hunter-gatherer arrows in the farming sites, and you get hand axes, farming axes, and all this like in the Mesolithic areas. And it was brutal. And so there was obviously more than just a subsistence problem there. There was a clash of cultures. And you sort of see farming as sort of an explosion or a wave that started off as an adaptation, a typically human adaptation, and how it started to push hunter-gatherer communities out of business. And yeah, so I think by that point, farming is no longer an experiment. It's sort of becoming dominant. And of course, it comes with a total shift. It's all new. You know, these boundaries, this ownership, this territory and expectations are the way of behaving that fit this new lifestyle and the old ways that don't. So yeah, I think farming it spread there, you know, and across Europe and to the whole. It could take several episodes to really follow the trajectory of this. And I think the point is that all these farming cultures, they weren't a stagnant thing. They were small communities, really, that, you know, generation after generation splintered off, and new ways were invented and new tools were invented and different crops, different animals, different ideas. It opened up a whole new industry. And I think if you trace it back from the Levant and Anatolia into Europe, it sort of, we get to a point where you step into sort of the, from the Stone Age, and then and you head into, from the Neolithic into the Bronze and Iron Ages, and you get all these different innovations and different technologies that wouldn't have happened if farming hadn't have happened in the first place. And that's when you started to get the big shifts and the bigger towns, the bigger cities, and then the empires and the fighting over land. It all comes from this trying to control of resource rather than being, as we had for hundreds of thousands of years and millions of years, if you want to go down that route, of existing with nature rather than trying to sort of control and own. It becomes, I don't know, I think, I suppose another way of looking at it is that prior to farming, we've got a relationship with nature, and after that, we've got an insecure relationship, trying to control and dominate things that we have no business trying to, because we live on a planet and it's been doing its thing for millions of years. But again, we are also, that's not an anti-human thing. We are an evolution in ourselves. You know, we're part of the fractals. We've come from the planet. So we're supposed to be here. We evolved here. What we do is what this planet has given us the opportunity to do. I think now we should probably move on then to rather than going through archaeological sites and the spread of farming around the world, which is an incredible story, and I'll definitely do an episode on that. In fact, I'll probably have to do quite a few episodes on that. But for now, let's talk about, because obviously we're looking through the neurodivergent lens, this sort of the human impact, because this farming, as I said, it brings this incredible change, not just in how we live, but the impact that humanity has on the planet. And as part of our story, we've already mentioned some figures with population growth, but we also get something new, which is guaranteed food surplus. I mean, it's not guaranteed if the harvests fail, obviously, but or disease takes root. But as a general idea, the idea of farming is that you have stores and surplus, whereas hunter-gathering, if you have a bad few weeks, or you only need about 5 bad days and you're done for, whereas in farming you can store more than a year's worth of food, so you have that surplus. And it also grants or affords this, because not everybody had to be a farmer, where everybody had, there's lots of different roles in hunter-gatherer societies, obviously, but in farming you could start to you could get specialization. You could get full-time smiths, artists, creators, engineers, whatever were needed. And these specialist roles afforded civilization. You could build aqueducts and bridges and reservoirs and field systems and roads and whatever else you needed. And that's where you get that sort of explosion from town, little villages, the temporary, to towns, to cities, to empires. But of course, it wasn't all good news, not least for the local environment and the local animals and insects and all these things, the biodiversity. But also, we get disease problems, we get malnutrition because we limit our diet, and we also get repetition, which is something I really struggle with, and hard labor as well. It's, there's a lot of back-breaking work. Obviously, from a hunter-gatherer sense, especially if you think about our Neanderthal ancestors, all our ancestors doing all this hunting and whatnot is incredibly challenging and dangerous, and there would have been many injuries. But when you get to farming, you get all these sort of repetitive tasks of clearing the fields and all this hard labour. And weirdly, you actually see some changes from the hunter-gatherers to the early farmers. Early farmers are often shorter and less healthy and more prone to illness, possibly more related to how diet became narrower, because obviously life being more structured, you and your food resources going from season availability of as you move through the landscape, you actually, if you're going to live, yes, you might have this food surplus, but if a lot of that surplus is grain, then you're already limiting your diet. And you see this in teeth and bones and all sorts of interesting ways in the archaeological record. And yeah, I suppose there's this other change as well, from an immediate return as you're hunting and gathering. You walk around and you get that buzz of finding some fruit or seeds or animals or something that you need. Replace that where you plant something and you wait, or you domesticate something, you breed from it, and you have to wait and you have to hope that it survives and that you get to reap those benefits. And from a neurodiverse perspective, some minds, that shift matters deeply. That move from sort of a flexible, responsive environments to structured, repetitive ones. And that's not a small change. It's an entire change. It's flipping the coin, And I think from a farming perspective, if you think about this wave that we talk about from the very first farmers and the spread around the world of farming, this story, it becomes very, very real because farming hasn't stopped expanding. It hasn't stopped taking over the world. It hasn't stopped changing, even within a few generations. I mean, from my perspective, so I'm from farming families, and I remember, seeing photos of my great grandfather with shire horses to my granddad's first tractor during the Second World War. We've moved very quickly from much more traditional mixed farming to mechanization and fertilizers and pesticides and specialization. You're now just a dairy farm, or you're now just a sheep farm, or you're now just an arable farm. Now, a lot of this comes off the back of the Second World War, because there was obviously a huge push to produce more food. So land farming intensified and outputs increased just to keep people alive, just to keep enough food for everybody. And you know, it worked, but it came with consequences because modern farming is obviously responsible for a lot of soil damage and biodiversity loss and environmental strain. And now, weirdly, we're shifting again and asking new questions. I mean, we were organic for the last 30 years, I think. And so this kind of question is pertinent to me. I mean, how do we farm more sustainably? How do we repair the ecosystems? And how do we still feed billions of people? And at the same time, very excitingly, farming's also moving back into cities. Because if you think about it initially, the first farmers would have all been farmers to a certain extent, certainly farming families, and that farming was outside the front door. And as towns and cities grew, that farming was pushed further away from people, and people were more separated from farming, but also from nature. And now, through vertical farms and lab-grown food, we're actually producing food in cities. We're sort of moving back in a little bit, which is a huge... I mean, think about it in terms of if we invest in this technology and suddenly within the next generation or two, we can produce a lot of the food for cities within the cities themselves. We cut down on huge environmental loss and travel mileage and all this lot. And people could, I mean, hoping that, you know, eventually people could have their own farm within their own houses. You know, maybe it takes up a corner of the room and it's banging out salads left, right and centre. I mean, let's hope so. So that maybe that's the next phase of farming, and maybe this farming is being shaped by people who've never even farmed. So hopefully there'll be no limitations to this. And from, I think, because I don't know, from a personal point of view, I'm being reflective here. I do sometimes wonder, coming from a farming background, you know, am I still part of that initial wave? You know, if my family and ancestors always been farmers, it's likely, but not, I don't know how to prove that. It's interesting to think that this movement began 12,000 years ago, and it's not just that it hasn't really finished, it's likely not going to end. You know, we're always going to create, assuming we don't blow ourselves up or ruin it in some other way, it's very likely that population pressure is just going to keep going and going. And that's okay if we can manage it in a sensible way. But we've got to think about the environment, and also we've got to think about people. You know, how do we cope with that? You know, there's so many neurodivergent people are living lives that their nervous systems can't cope with. And you've got to try and imagine, how are they going to get, you know, in 100 years, in 1,000 years, in 10,000 years, in 100,000 years? How's that going to look? I mean, hopefully we've got some kind of wonderful space age coming our way. But I hope that we do find a way that we still get to remember who we are and what our journey's been, and also that our differences within larger communities have got to be recognised, and that we've got to be able to accommodate people and our sensitivities. You know, I mean, I look at my kids at school, you know, I've got a couple of them that are really struggling with the school environment, and that's even with all this awareness. And, you know, the schools talk a good game about looking after neurodivergent kids, and I don't think they actually get what that actually entails. I think it's just a piece of paper with a few lines that say, oh yeah, you have to allow for this, that and the other. But do we understand that these kids are hypersensitive and their nervous systems are just not coping with that rigidity and the lack of daylight and the lack of nature? So, yeah, I think farming, it's got a lot to answer for. It's given us an awful lot. We've gone from millions of years of stone tools to, you know, and hundreds of thousands of years hunting and gathering. In just a few thousand years, we've been on the moon. We've been round the moon. You know, we've all got technology that was mind-blowing 20 years ago, let alone 50 years ago or 10,000 years ago. So what this exponential effect on the human story is and where it's going is yet to be determined. And I'd love to think about it. You know, was farming a good idea? I mean, it gave us everything, but it also complicated everything. But maybe the most important thing it did was create a world where different minds experienced life differently. Okay, and from a Nero Pride point of view, if your mind doesn't quite fit in into the environment that you're in, that's not a flaw. It's a reflection of a much older world, of that you've been part of a much, much bigger story. And I think because innovation is accelerating and the minds that question also imagine and create, and then those are the minds that are shaping what come next. And neurodiverse people are sensational at that. And so if farming was the beginning of this big experiment, we're still living in it and the story isn't finished yet. But before we finish, I want to come back to, and I'm sorry if you don't think I've gone into enough detail with farming in an archaeological sense, because I really haven't. We've just sort of used farming as a lens, really, rather than this being an episode on purely on farming, its origins, because it is a magnificent story. It's truly epic and sensational. You look at the epic things that came out of it. You know, we haven't even talked about how quickly we went from no real human structures to Stonehenge and the pyramids and these great civilizations and whatnot. So there's tons to talk about there, and there's loads of material out there. So go fill your boots. But for the purpose of this podcast and this particular episode, I just want to sort of finish with something we touched on at the beginning, which was the idea or the theory that's often called the hunter-farmer theory. And it's not strictly archaeology, and it's not something we can prove in a clean scientific way, but it's a great way to think about it, and it's incredibly useful, basically. And the idea of it is that some of the traits we now associate with ADHD may have made a lot more sense in hunter-gatherer environments, like the sort of high awareness, constantly scanning, sensitivity to movement, sound and change, and that ability to switch attention quickly, to react fast, and to take risks when they were needed in that world where survival depended on noticing things early and moving through the landscape and adapting constantly. Those traits weren't a disadvantage. They were so useful, essential, that that's before that environment changes. And I can't remember who I saw. I either saw the video, this is my ADHD in action, I either saw the video or read it, I can't remember, but there was this great image given to me that hunter-gatherer community sat around a fire, and you got the neurodivergent person who's just struggling with the noise and sits back a little bit, so they're not quite in the middle of it all, there's too many people in there, it's a bit overwhelming, so they sit back a little bit, and then they hear a branch snap, and before they know it, they've jumped out into the dark with a spear and plunged it into a saber-toothed tiger and saved everyone. So they're obviously a bit of a Marvel Comics take on it, but it's a really good, useful example of where that sort of the impulsivity and distractibility has and will have many countless times saved an individual, a family, a community. So when you're struggling to focus at work or in a classroom or in a conversation, your nervous system has got millions of years of information telling it to focus here, to focus there, to listen. Everything is just as important, not just one thing, not just what that person's telling you. Yes, okay, in this environment, you're being persecuted because you can't remember and you can't focus, but that's not your fault. That's the gift that kept humanity alive. And it was only with the onset of agriculture, with farming, that life became more structured, where you stayed in one place and you repeat the same tasks and you follow seasonal cycles and you wait for the outcomes. And suddenly those traits that once helped and saved communities and help people thrive don't fit in as easily, and they're seen as a nuisance, and they get labels and medication and punishments. And then this is where I think the theory becomes powerful, because it tells us exactly what happened. Not that it tells us exactly what happened, but because it changes the question. Instead of asking what's wrong with me, it asks what kind of environment was this nervous system shaped for. And archaeology is really good at that. It reminds us that the world hasn't always looked like this. It's, especially if you're stuck in a culture that promotes the same things, the same clothes, the same music, the same classrooms, the same lessons, the same outcomes. Everybody's got to give the same answer, and everybody gets an A if they do that, and all that. That's a modern world. That's a very short period of time that life's been like that. you know, in evolutionary terms, it's, what was the old Bill Bryson one in his Short History of Nearly Everything? He stretched out his arms and said, from the tips of one finger to the fingernail of his other arm is everything before humanity. And if you scratch the end off, there we go. It's a bit like that in terms of from farming to today, it is a tiny period. 12,000 years sounds like a long time, but compared to millions of years, it's nothing. And same thing in terms of this sort of modern world we live in, you know, past the age of empires, we're all sort of putting pens, as we mentioned earlier. So you consider that for most of human history, life was mobile and varied and unpredictable. And within that world, there was space for many different ways of thinking and being. So when we talk about neurodiversity today, we're not just talking about modern conditions, we're talking about variation. And that's likely existed, well, it has existed for a very long time. And maybe what farming did was not create those differences, but to change how they were experienced and then perceived. So change with traits, also change which traits were rewarded and which became harder to live with. And that brings us back to something we've touched on throughout this episode. Farming didn't just domesticate plants and animals. It began to shape human behavior, our expectations, our routines, the norms. And over time, those expectations became kind of invisible. That's just the way things are. But that's not the way things are. That's what we've created. and they're part of a system. And this system began relatively recently in human terms, and we're still adjusting to it. So, yeah, I think when we think about it, especially coming from a farming background, I do sometimes wonder how much of this is still playing out, not just historically, but how we live today. You know, we haven't finished evolving and the story's not over. You know, in 100,000 years, people will be looking back at us. I don't know what they'll be thinking there. But yeah, I don't know, if the hunter farmer theory holds even a little bit of truth, then traits like curiosity and intensity, creativity, sensitivity, and fast thinking, they're not flaws. They're part of a much older story. And I think you've got to get a handle on that as well, because growing up where you're given a lot of negative information about yourself, you know, you're too loud, you're too noisy, you're too messy, you're too forgetful, you get a terrible view of yourself. But in all honesty, from all my experience through my neurodivergent story, from my diagnosis and awareness and the research and coaching and therapy and things I've done, we really got to get some pride into this, because it's not a failing. It's just our interpretation of what we are that is distorted and wrong. We're part of a much, much older story. So maybe the real question isn't how do we fix our traits, it's how do we build a world that understands them and needs us, because the world needs us. So yeah, I think I don't really know what else to say at this point. There's so much more we could talk about with farming and hunter-farmer theory and being neurodivergent in the post-farming world. So, or post-hunter-gatherer world, I suppose, isn't it? We're in the farming world, so... Yeah, I don't know. I'd love to hear your thoughts. If you have any, find me on Instagram at the minute. I still not sorted out my social media presence, but I'm sure I'll get around to it at some point. But yeah, I've got another episode left in this series, which will be out in a couple of weeks, and then we're going to move on to something slightly different for season 3. So yeah, thank you for your company. I hope you're doing well, and I hope this episode has helped you get a little perspective on neurodiversity and the impact of farming. And yeah, love to you all. Thanks so much for listening. I'll catch up with you soon. Cheers. Bye-bye.
Thanks for listening to this podcast. The Archaeology Podcast Network's chief editor is Rachel Roden. Our executive producer is Ashley Airy. Our social media and newsletter coordinator is Matilda Siebrecht. The APN was founded by Chris Webster and Tristan Boyle on December 1st, 2014. We're supported by our amazing podcast hosts, many volunteers, and listeners like you. Check out membership at www.archpodnet.com/members.
This has been a presentation of the Archaeology Podcast Network. Visit us on the web for show notes and other podcasts at www.archpodnet.com. Contact us at chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com.